Good morning and welcome to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley, along with my good friend and co-host, Sixto Molina. Good morning, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Ackerley.
Did we get some golf in this week with that wonderful weather that we had all week long?
No, unfortunately, I had some back issues. So I was sidelined.
All that playing over in New Mexico, huh? Got your back going, huh? We'll have to get you into therapy this week, so that'll be great. Bill Ackerley is here as always, and thanks to Matt Neely for all you do. And this is The Morning Voice, and we have a hot one lined up for you this morning. That was a good one, wasn't
Indeed.
It? Yeah, there we go. Our guest today is Dan Bryce of Bryce Farms in St. David, Arizona. Good morning, Dan. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks.
We sure had a wonderful time, a nice visit. Jesse and Carol Lugo, Sue Darling and I came down last Saturday morning and met your grandkids and granddaughter-in-law, and what a great experience that was. And I just have to tell you, the chilies are delicious, and the pecans, I told you a little bit earlier, I think I gave my wife three of them, and I ate the rest of them over the last week. They're just phenomenal. So wonderful. Well, Dan, tell us a little story behind Bryce Farms, and how did you first get started growing green chilies?
Well, I've always been a little bit of a nerd as far as dirt goes. From a very early age, I always had a little patch in my mom's flower garden, and that's just developed over the years. I ended up getting married and having a few kids, and figured they needed to learn a few things, how to work and how to interact with people. And so I used that as leverage to convince my wife that maybe a little farm would work. So we pursued that course, and sometimes the kids didn't really appreciate that, but now it's interesting that they want to make sure that their children come back and see what's going on the farm. And so it's been good for me, good therapy, good for kids, good for grandkids.
That's wonderful. Yeah. You know, my company was started in 1968 by my father and mother. And they went way out on a limb really creatively and called it Ackerley Advertising. So wonderful. Obviously, Bryce Farms gets its name from you. Is this the first generation of Bryce Farms on you, or did your folks or grandfolks have a Bryce Farm as well?
Well, my folks, grandfolks, and great-grandfolks, you might know of an Ebenezer Bryce up in Utah, Bryce Canyon.
Oh, yes.
And he was a cattleman and a farmer, and ended up moving kind of down through Arizona. The Gila Valley is where most of them reside. They kind of ran me off, and so I came a little further south.
So. Yeah, you came to the good country, though, I got to tell you. This is Sixto here. So.
Yeah, Dan, what motivated you to focus specifically on green chilies? Was it tradition, climate, or something else?
Well, it was something, you know, today's agriculture is so big, and to be able to even break even, you have to find a niche. And I'm from New Mexico originally, and chili kind of got in my blood. I came over to southeastern Arizona and found a couple places to start farming, and chilies worked. It was a good way to get kids involved, and it's a good way to interact with people. I love getting feedback from the people that buy our products. What did they like? What did they not like? Southeast Arizona, interestingly enough, particularly Cochise County, is one of the best places to develop seed, particularly chili. It has one of the highest weed pressures and one of the highest insect pressures, as well as disease. So if you can get something that survives here, there's a good chance it's going to survive elsewhere. And that's where Curry Seed, there in Sunsites, has developed a number of different varieties and continues to work on improving the chili. So probably more information you wanted, but there you go.
So a follow-up question, Dan. create the seed, and is this seed provided to the chili farms in New Mexico?
Yeah, so Curry Farms there in Sunsites, they develop and they'll work for years. A lot of the chili we will never see. When they get it pretty close, they start letting a little bit out, and I've been fortunate to develop a relationship with them. And I generally get a look at some of those early releases. In fact, I'll be going over there here in a month or so to look at new stuff that they're working on currently that'll be coming out in a few years. So it, to me, it's fascinating.
Yeah, when we were down there on Saturday, Dan, you were talking about how you're transferring seedlings over to the ground, and what an interesting process that you've developed. Tell us a little bit about how you get them started and then how you transplant them over into the rows that you make.
Sure. So years ago, in fact, I can still do it. I can plant seed in the ground and it'll come up, but we don't get the spring rains. And we can come back and talk about water here in a bit. But we had to figure out some other way to do it to get the chili to not die off, if you will. Because if you put it in the ground, that little tender seedling, once you get a hot day, it activates the salt and it'll burn that little plant coming out of the ground, and you'll lose 60-70% of your stand. So we went to transplants. I talked to Ed Curry over there, and he said, why don't you try that? We, for a while, were getting the transplants out of Yuma and Southern California, but I only use about 20,000 transplants a year, and that's not enough for the people that grow the transplants to mess with. So we had to figure out how to do it. So we have what we call germination chambers, which is sounds kind of high-tech, but all it is a number of refrigerators or freezers, and we put a crock pot in the bottom, and that provides the moisture and the heat, and we put a thermostat on there, and we maintain that at 80 degrees. So depending on the cultivar, it will take anywhere from as little as 3 to 5 days to as much as 5 to 10 days. Some of those are even longer than that, but that's generally the plants that we use. That's generally what we have. Now, once you see the knuckles coming through the medium that we're planting them in, we have a couple of little greenhouses and we move them out there. And they go into shock for a little bit because it's not quite as cozy as it was in the chambers. And then they will come on up, start forming leaves. Generally, again, depending on the cultivar, it'll take maybe 6 to 8 weeks before it's ready to go in the ground. And there we have to start looking at Mother Nature. Do we see a freeze coming up? Do we, do we need to get them out sooner? So all of that starts to come into play. So it keeps you humble, because whenever you guess, your certain amount of those guesses are not going to be correct. But then we stick them in the ground. We have what we call a water wheel transplanter. And there's two people set on the back of that. And as the wheel goes around, it makes a indentation. And you put the plant in there, and we give it a drink of water, usually about a cup. And we plant enough rows to where we can get the drip turned on. And the drip tape that we use puts a drip in the ground and waters just the plant. So we've been able to reduce our water usage by from flood probably close to 70%. Some of the other options are probably 50%, but we've made a significant reduction in our water usage. So we've become more efficient. The plants themselves have become more efficient. We get more with less. And I think you have to do that. Our resources are finite, and we just have to make sure we're making the most of what we have.
Right. So with the strange monsoon pattern that we've had this summer, where I think we started in June and maybe July, and maybe it came and maybe it went, and maybe it came back and maybe it went, and maybe it came back, and maybe it's here again this weekend. That obviously, having that drip irrigation for the chilies is probably a good thing, because not that we can't count on the rain, but you can't count on Mother Nature to be exact in terms of scheduling. So rain has been an interesting dilemma for you, correct?
Oh, it's been, again, another thing that keeps you humble. We tried some, we were predicted to have a wetter than normal monsoon. So we actually tried a little bit of dry land Mexican June corn, which is what they use for tamale corn. In fact, when we moved here close to 45 years ago, the old timers would tell you, just put the corn out there last of June, and you get enough monsoon that it'll keep it going.
Right.
That does not happen in today's world. Right. Normally, we'll get 8, 10, maybe 12 inches in a monsoon. Up until this week, we had just a little over 2 inches.
Wow. So you really
we are extremely
dry. Yeah, you have to really react with the nature playing tricks on us as we get into this. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and talk some more about wonderful, delicious green chilies from Bryce Farms in St. David. Our guest today on The Morning Voice is Dan Bryce, the owner of Bryce Farms in St. David, Arizona. And Sixto and I will be back in just a minute with more on The Morning Voice. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. Our guest is Dan Bryce of Bryce Farms in St. David, and I'm joined in studio with Sixto Molina. Sixto, have you been to Bryce Farms yet?
Not yet.
How about you, Matt? Have you been down to Bryce Farms?
I've not, but
we're going to get
Mrs.
you down
Neely
there.
And I, we're talking about doing it this season, so maybe tomorrow or next Saturday.
That's
so
great.
With
an
away football game, I think we can get away with that.
Yeah. So, Dan, it was a pleasure to be down there last Saturday, and you're out there most Saturdays during the season here. You said maybe through the mid part or late part of October, Saturday mornings, right?
That's correct. Yeah, part of that depends on Mother Nature. So,
if it's a downpour, you may not be out selling chilies. But if it's a nice, it was a beautiful Saturday last Saturday. I do have to say two things. One, I told your grandkids I was going to tell this story. You can tell you've been a farmer for a long time. You hopped into the jitney bug. I don't know what you call your four wheeler there, and you were going back to the house to get something. And you must have been going 63 miles an hour backwards in a four-wheeler. It was amazing how straight you were driving. You've obviously done that 9,652,000 times, so that was pretty amazing. Your grandkids and I were laughing about how fast you can go backwards. One of the things I wanted to mention was your little tutorial that you gave us, which I always thought that green chilies, that the hotness came from the seeds. And so I was always told, don't touch the seeds, get the seeds out of your chilies. This is important. And you schooled me that that's not exactly right. It's that gold band that you were showing me, that gold, those gold beads. Tell us a little bit about the gold beads.
Well, I've heard a lot of things over the years about what makes chili hot. And it's always interesting to hear from the experts that come and buy chili. But the truth is, there's an oil, the capsaicin, and chili is really the only one plant that has that. There are other types, but chili is the only one that really has those capsaicin cells in them. So what happens is, that's actually an oil. And if you open a chili up, some of them will have a yellow pigment. That's not necessarily the capsaicin. What you're looking for, and sometimes it's hard to distinguish, you're looking for little beads. Mm-hmm. And some of those, the more pronounced those are, My guess is you're going to get an awakening shortly if you touch any sensitive part of your body.
Right.
If it becomes orange, that can really cause some long-term registration that you had some pretty hot chili earlier, and it'll last with you for quite a while.
Yeah.
But that capsaicin is what we're looking for. We have a variety called carne dura, and that one is pretty mild. Once in a while, you'll find that's something else. People want it all to be one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is in genetics, if you come up to 100% in any one area, you probably have given up some other trait. It might be plant structure. It might be canopy to cover the fruit, keep it from sunburning. You never want a complete 100%. You can get pretty close, but you don't want necessarily 100% because that means you probably gave up on some other trait.
It was quite interesting to watch you slice open a chili. You started with the mild, the ones that I got, and you showed me the little line of gold beads, yellow beads.
Yep.
And then you moved on and you got up to that really hot one, and holy smokes, you could just visually see it, and there was more capsaicin oil in it, and it made some sense, and heat is heat is heat. And I did touch that to my lips, and it was still thinking about it. Still thinking about it.
Dan, does size matter?
No.
So there's some big green chilies, and then there's some smaller ones, and does that come into play?
No, it really doesn't. It can, depending on the variety. It's more a function of variety than capsaicin within the chili. Interestingly enough, at the present time, my hot and extra hot are a little smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of the size of the chili comes from what the canners want. My customers want a nice big chili. The bigger, the better. But the canners and the restaurants want something that'll fit in a can or fit on a plate. So the breeders have had to go back and shrink the chili, get it a little smaller. They want it still pretty thick and wide, but they don't want it very long. So part of that is just the function of the plant breeders making their selections. So, one of the things that you will often see as far as hotness goes, you'll see a little, not always, but it's not uncommon to see a duller, darker green. I don't know what it is, but when you get that dullness, there's a good chance. In fact, if we're picking hot or extra hot, if we break a chili, we tend to want to get cleaned up pretty quick because sooner or later you're going to touch your nose or lips or eyes or something, and it's going to not be very comfortable.
We got just a few minutes left. Let's just talk a little bit about what people can expect. First off, how do you get to St. David? You go down I-10 to what turnoff do you turn at?
Take any of the Benson turnoffs and head toward Tombstone. And just after you cross the San Pedro River Bridge, we're about a mile on the south side of the road there. And we'll have banners out and so forth. And what we want people, I prefer people to try what they're getting.
Right.
I want them to be happy. I don't want them to get home and have a surprise. It's not hot enough or it's too hot. I want to make sure they have sampled that before they make a commitment, and maybe they don't want any, but still the education, I think, is part of the function there that we provide.
We were just, I personally was just enthralled by what you were doing. And even when you were cooking them over there in your little cooker. That was kind of cool to watch those go in green and come out blistered and ready to go. And it was also interesting that you said that not to bring down an ice chest to put them in so that they continue to heat while you're driving back to Tucson. If you're going to put them in an ice chest, put them on ice so that they stop cooking. So, yeah.
See, that's one of the things. The roasting is not just one size fits all. Mm-hmm. At different times of the year, the moisture content and additionally the wall thickness and the skin will have different characteristics. So we want a fresh chili to get as much moisture in there as we can so that we can create steam to create a blister and blister that skin away. We don't want to cook it away. We mm-hmm. want to blister it away. Right. And so that when you get home, you still have some consistency and it's not mush like you were talking about.
Right. Well, we really appreciate the education we got about green chilies from Bryce Farms in St. David last Saturday. If you're not doing anything tomorrow or the next couple of Saturdays, get yourself down to Bryce Farms. It's an amazing experience. You do not have to go to New Mexico to get the best chilies in the Southwest. Dan, it's a pleasure meeting you and pleasure interacting with you and your family last Saturday. And best of luck to you in the future. We'll have you back on soon.
Thank you. God bless you all.
This is KVOI 1030 AM, Tucson's live local talk radio, and you are listening to The Morning Voice. We'll be back after a break. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. My name is Dr. Ed Ackerley. In the studio with me is Sixto Molina. Good morning, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Ackerley. Glad to be here.
And Matt Neely is over there behind the glass. And
hello.
What a great discussion with Dan.
What I like about Dan, he takes the actual growing of chili so seriously about the hybrids and the science of it. And the structure of the fruit. And he came on one time on the old show and brought a bunch of different samples. And Jesse was here. I don't think you were here, but Jesse was here. And so they all were greatly amused at my reaction to the machete chili the various ones that they brought. So,
it was pretty amazing. He would grab one out of the bag and he'd take his little knife there. Wasn't a little knife, it's a pocket knife that he has. And he'd start slicing these chilies. And I'm like, man, that knife is so sharp. And he obviously has been handling it for 50 years because it's amazing how he is just a artist when it comes to opening up those chilies. So you've been going to Hatch and getting chilies at Hatch. We're going to get you down there and have you look and see if there's any down there you like.
Yeah, I'd like to go to Bryce Farms and check it out. But I've been a chili eater all my life. In fact, we ran out of time, but I was going to ask him what his opinion was about chili having an impact on medicine.
Right.
And I haven't had a cold or a flu in over 20, 25 years. And I eat a lot of green chili, and a lot of people that I talked to said green chili has some properties.
You're not the only one I've heard that swears by that. Yeah.
Yep. It's that capsaicin oil in it. I mean, that stuff can take the varnish off of a piece of wood or the finish off your car. It is, Sue got the hot one and just took a taste of it. And she handed me a piece of it. And oh my goodness gracious! It was light your hair on fire. It was delicious. But the chili is delicious. The taste of it, but that hotness comes. So Jesse got a bag of giant bag of extra hot. The big giant. Extra hot. Oh my goodness gracious. And I don't know what he's going to do with them, but those are hot, hot, hot.
Well, there's a variety. It's 3X.
Wow.
And that is super hot.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's tough to eat, even for me.
You know, when we go out to lunch and stuff and you order salsa and you get the hottest that they can give you, ketchup is too hot for me, and and so is vanilla ice cream, and it's great to have the mild chilies that he has. You can almost eat them like an apple; they're just so delicious, and really good. But we had him roast them for us as well. So I've got a bag of roasted milds. I gave the hot ones that I got to my son who lives up in the White Mountains and runs over to Hatch every once in a while to get some chilies. So he was pretty excited that he got some really really good chilies coming. So. It was great. Well, we got a football game coming up tomorrow, and you got a big family gathering. I'm going to go over to the Boom Boom Room and watch the game. What do you think about our chances against Iowa State?
I think our chances are very good. I saw Iowa State on TV last week, and they're good, but I think we can beat them.
Yeah. What do you think, Matt?
I think if Arizona's defense shows up the way they have in the first three games, we got a good chance even on the road. If Arizona's defense has a bad game, then I don't know.
It is amazing how good Arizona teams have always built their success on defense.
Amen.
And even during the Dick Tomey little guy up the middle offense, it was all about the great defense that we had that would stop them. I guess it's just like voting. If you can preclude somebody from putting points up on the board, then you win. So it's pretty amazing. So it'll be interesting. The other thing I've noticed is on our offense is they've got Fifita running a little bit more.
Yep.
Not so much standing. Of course, they don't have Tetoro McMillan anymore, which I guess he could just stand back there and just throw it 50 times a game, and he would catch 40% of them or 80% of them, I mean, the other way around. But it's interesting how they just have Fifita running a little bit now, and for a little guy, he's pretty swift, and he's got some moves on him, and that kind of messes with the defense on the other side when they don't know whether he's a
threat.
Keeps
him honest.
Yeah, whether or not he's a threat to run. And then he's a pretty accurate passer, too.
Yeah, so. I've got to believe that we haven't seen all the bag of tricks that Arizona has.
Right.
And I think they're going to reveal some new tricks in tomorrow's game.
I was on the campus on, I guess it was Thursday. Oh, it is today. Today's Friday. So it might have been Wednesday, but I think it was Thursday. And I saw it was Wednesday night, and Coach Brennan was walking down the middle of the campus and everything, and there were a couple of people that recognized him. He's still so new that I think some of the kids still don't know that. They're, oh my goodness gracious, there goes Brent Brennan, and it was nice. You know, he's a good guy, and I think he's earning some respect and that he deserves. And everyone that I know in the inner circle tells me what a great guy he is and what a nice. He's much more like Dick Tomey than maybe the last couple of coaches that we've had. So.
He's pretty versatile. I saw a news clip, I think it was Channel 9, where he was at Phoenix International Raceway racing a NASCAR Cup car.
Yeah.
And that's pretty cool.
Yeah, doing some different things. It'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to watch and see how we do. You know, Bill and I are followers of, I'm a follower anyways, of Tyler Loop. He's been doing well with the Baltimore Ravens the last couple of games, and he's warming up. He's hitting them from 70 yards out, and it's going to be interesting. That's going to be the new norm, I think, in the college game, and perhaps the pro game is this 70-yard field goal, which is pretty amazing that they can kick them that far now.
So I knew this was going to come up. I think last weekend in the NFL, somebody hit a 70-yarder, and right. My immediate thought was, and I figured this would come up between us, was that Tyler Loop. I wouldn't be surprised to see him pull that off as well.
I've seen him kick a 70-yarder in, you know, never in a game situation. He's 62 is
62.
His long.
62. Nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah, but I've seen him kick a 70-yarder in practice, and he's able to do it. And I don't know if it's the ball, the weather, the dynamics, I don't know what it is, why has it been 100 years that 60 yards was kind of the limit, and now it's 70 yards? That's just interesting to me, that whole process.
I think the indoor stadiums have a lot to do with it.
Well,
because you have consistent weather inside the stadium. You don't have the thick air like you do in some cities.
Right.
And the ball flies a little further.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, he's doing great. They gave him the field goal when it went through. Was it the field goal? Was it an extra point? I forget. I think it was a field goal, and it went over the top of the crossbar or the goalpost. And the rule is that all part of the ball has to be inside that far end of the goalpost. And you look at it. I guess if you're a referee and you're looking straight up, you can see it. On TV, it looked like it was just a smidgen over to the light. So it's kind of like balls and strikes in MLB. They gave it to him because it was a long one, and it was pretty good. So he's a good kid, and he's doing great. We got some other McMillan's doing great down in Jacksonville. So it's interesting to watch football and see how it has evolved over the last few years.
Yeah, it's football brings this community together, and you know
you have a unique perspective on that. I think
yeah,
that's great.
I do, because it's one place. You know, we have a divided country right now. We have a divided city, but Arizona Stadium is a place where we can go and root for one team and be united. And I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. That along with maybe going into McHale Center is the same way. Yep. You get but getting 50,000 people all in the same place rooting for the same thing as opposed to cutthroat being against each other. We still have you sit with me, and we have some knucklehead fans from the U of A who sit in front of us that tend to start a little. We're on the visitor sideline, and so there's usually sprinkled throughout our section there'll be some people that are buying one-time tickets, and there's this one gentleman that's a good friend of yours who starts mouthing off about the other team and so forth, and you know, over the last couple of years he's had a few run-ins with fans, and I'm like, for me personally, it ruins the game for me to have our fans barking at the kids on the sideline or barking at the other people's fans. I think we you have good days and bad days, and sometimes you win and sometimes you lose, and you shouldn't be a sore loser about it. But I know you do a good job of talking to him and being a good friend of his, but I'm like, stop that already.
Well, you know, having been a cop, the first thing they teach you in the police academy from day one is you treat everybody equally.
Right.
And so that's why I don't get too excited when people don't agree with me or they do agree with me. I try to keep a monotone attitude.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's great the way you do that, because it's hard for me to be gracious sometimes, because to me it destroys the great University of. I personally don't. I mean, I do care. I want the U of A to win, but so many times, you know, we're there. We just like to watch good football, and sometimes the other team, the Troy Aikmans of the world, and the Marcus Mariotas, and the people that are playing at some of these big schools, and they go on and have 15-year careers at the NFL. We can say we saw them play when they came to the University of Arizona. To me, that's as exciting as it is to, obviously I want the U of A to win, but just the whole experience of that is pretty great. Well, let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We're getting ready for a little bit with Jane Hamilton and some wonder coming up after the break. This is The Morning Voice on KVOI.
At 7:48, with a look at your traffic and weather, I'm Matt Neely on 10:30 The Voice. There's an injury crash, Kolb and Lakeside Drive. And a couple of accidents, Broadway and Pantano Road, and Speedway at Mountain. Taking a look at your freeways. Still have some slowing on eastbound Ajo between Old Ajo Way and Mission, actually Holiday Isle, and eastbound I-10, slowing between Cortero and Sunset Links. It looks like that's kind of on again, off again. Westbound I-10, slowing between Craycroft and Valencia. Tucson weather, high today 90 degrees. 70% chance of showers this afternoon. Thunderstorms, overnight low 64. 50% chance of showers this afternoon, this evening. 86 for your high tomorrow with a 30% chance of showers. 73 is the current temperature under partly cloudy skies. Now back to The Morning Voice.
Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley, along with my co-host, Sixto Molina. Good morning again, Sixto.
Good morning, sir.
Bill Ackerley's here. Dr. Vance Holliday is here. Matt Neely's back behind the glass. We're going to talk a little bit here with our good friend, Jane Hamilton of Jane Hamilton Fine Arts. Good morning to you, Jane.
Hi, how are you?
one of my favorites. You are a fantastic person. You brought along a friend with you today, huh?
Yep. Today I brought Rusty Booth, and Rusty is a kitchen designer with Davis Kitchens that you're familiar with.
Yes, I am. It's a point of personal privilege. When I was about 20 years old working for my dad's advertising agency, I went out and saw Jim Davis, and the very first client that I got on the air was Davis Kitchens back 157,000 years ago, and Jim and Retha went on to own Kid Center, and they're retired now, and then we also helped the other side of the family. They had a place called House and Garden Furniture, and that was Richard's brother. Harlan was the owner of House and Garden. So we live in Tucson long enough, you get to know everybody.
There
I think
you
that's
go.
Pretty great.
Well, Rusty's new. He's been here a couple of years from Ohio.
Right.
And we're glad he joined our community.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about being a designer at Davis Kitchen. What's that like?
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me and Jane. it's the best job ever.
Yeah.
Excuse me. You know, you wake up And all you think about is kitchens and designing. And selling. And they've been in business 50 years. It's their 50th anniversary this year. So I've been doing it 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
But every morning I wake up and have the pleasure of thinking of designing or changing someone's life, heart of the home.
Right.
It's the heart of the kitchen.
It is. When you think about what goes on, especially at holidays and weekends and so forth, we were just talking about football and your wife. Sixto's wife is a phenomenal cook, and the boys, they're all grown. They have kids of their own and everything. But guess where they come? They come back to Mom's kitchen.
Yep.
Because she's a great cook. It is the center. It's really the center of your house when you go into your house. It's kind of the place where everybody gathers.
Yeah, it's right next to the living room. It's open, and it was designed by Davis Kitchens, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
Yeah.
We hear that a lot. 50% of the business I get, people come in and we say, what brings you in today? And Davis did my mom's house. Davis did. And when I first met you,
First
thing, it was your first sale.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that, you know, that resonates. That's kind of cool.
Right.
And even though big city, small town.
Yeah.
And so it's not what you know, it's who you know sometimes. And I was telling Jane on the way over here, we like to tell people, you know, it's not a kitchen. It's a Davis kitchen.
Right.
And that means something. That means a lot.
Yeah.
And to be around that long and do what you love is pretty cool.
Changed locations a couple of times. They were when I first started, it was over on Aviation Highway, whatever that's called now. It's no longer Aviation Highway. It's called State Route 963 or whatever it is. And then they moved over to Broadway and Kolb area, where the Toys R Us building used to be.
Yes. And we are thinking of relocating.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too big.
Right.
And bigger is not always better. Yeah. So we want to tighten the belt a little bit. We have too much, mm-hmm. and you can't be everything to everybody.
Right.
So it's not 100%, but hopefully soon we'll be moving to a smaller location.
Hopefully your landlord is not listening to this.
No, actually, that's worked out pretty well. It's just too big.
Yeah.
You know, it's so ginormous that
it's half of the old Toys R Us, right? So it's this big giant facility. Yeah.
And so it's just so spread out, and you can't show everything. People don't want 50 doors to look at. They want maybe 5 or 6.
Right.
And so smaller sometimes is better.
Right. So you basically are full service. Someone comes in, is thinking about getting a kitchen remodel or other places, but mostly a kitchen remodel. They come in and see a guy like you, and walk us through the process of what they're going to see. You know, if you go to a big box store, you go to try and do it yourself and so forth. You don't get the expertise and the knowledge and the creativity that you bring to the table. But also, it's kind of like buying your house for the first time. You need to have someone walk you through the process, especially if you've never done a kitchen remodel before. It's kind of a daunting thing if you don't know what you're doing.
It can be. And the most important thing I like to tell people, you know, we're in the service industry, and customer service is so important. So when someone comes in, you want to give as much information.
Mm-hmm.
You want to advise them. You know, we call it, we're not the big box store mentality.
Right.
It's all about customer service. So people come in and we ask, you know, what brings you in? Well, we're thinking of redoing our kitchen. So, you know, and there's so many things that go into that. Flooring, countertops, cabinets, lighting. So
doors.
Doors, color,
right.
Wood species. So we try to keep it simple.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it starts with the floor. You do the cabinets, countertops, tile. Appliances are huge.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a partnership with an appliance company. You need a good floor guy. So basically what Davis Kitchens does is we design, we sell cabinets, and we install.
Mm-hmm.
Also, what's important is we have a service department. We have our own drivers. We have 4 or 5 kitchen designers that are all professional. They've been in the industry. And so when you come into Davis, we try to take care of all the aspects of a remodel. Even though we don't sell appliances, that's a huge part of what we do.
We'll come back in just a minute with Jane Hamilton of Jane Hamilton Fine Art and Rusty Booth of Davis Kitchens. We'll talk a little bit more about updating your kitchen for the holidays. This is The Morning Voice on KVOI. We'll be back after the quick break. Good morning and welcome back to The Morning Voice. I'm with co-host Sixto Molina. Dr. Vance Holliday is standing by, ready to go for Wonder. We're going to finish up here with Jane and Rusty. Jane, you are Jane Hamilton of Jane Hamilton Fine Art Gallery. And before the break, Rusty was talking about customer service and about how he guides people who want a new kitchen from Davis Kitchens through that process. But I've seen you in action out at your place. Customer service is the reason we're in business, right?
There you go. So when people come in my gallery, hopefully they think it's beautiful and very eclectic in the wide variety of beautiful artwork and sculpture. And so there's that. And I like to work with my neighbors with art walks. We have one mm-hmm. next Thursday. Seven neighbors on both sides of the Foothills Art District.
4 to 7 p.m.?
4 to 7, next Thursday, October 2nd.
Got to do that. That's a great experience.
It's great. Yeah, we're featuring an artist that night, Karen Moran from Scottsdale. But beyond that, the usual thing I hear about my gallery, besides how much people like it, is they thank me for being hospitable, which means I have chairs and I offer water.
Right, right.
And you don't think that's important, but it really matters.
Right.
You get people walking around that are visiting, they're dehydrated, they have friends that are older maybe or need to sit and don't want to look at the art. So I always have chairs and right. a couch and I have water.
Right. And the neat thing I see when you're out there is you can be a guest in the Jane Hamilton Fine Art Gallery without buying anything. You can come and it's like a museum, if you will, an art gallery. Because you can come in and look at the beautiful art on the wall, framed and gorgeous, ready to go. But if you don't want to purchase anything, you don't have to, but you can still enjoy the space.
Right.
And the same thing is probably true, Rusty, of Davis Kitchens. If you're just thinking about it, it's a great place to come and just kind of look around and start dreaming about what you might be able to do. You don't have to have I'm going to get my kitchen done, and so I'm going to come in and then start the process. You don't have to do that. You can come in and look around, right?
No, so many people come in, and we're just looking. We're looking right. for ideas. Mm-hmm. And kitchens are always changing color. Stains are coming back. Mm-hmm. Warmer, cooler.
You mean
colors.
Avocado green is not the color anymore?
No, yeah. Green
and
actually.
And shag carpet.
Green's yeah. coming back.
And orange.
Orange, yeah.
But no, actually, green is big. But so people do come in and just look, and we encourage them to come in, take pictures.
Right.
You know, we hand out brochures, but we yeah. love people who come in just to walk yeah. in and say hi. And again, a lot of people come in and just say, oh, we've known you've been here. You
right.
did my mom's house. We're right. thinking about it.
So if somebody wants to get in touch with Davis Kitchens, where would they go? Who would they see? Who would they talk to? Where do they go?
Well, the showroom is open Monday through Friday, 9 to 5, mm-hmm. 5355 East Broadway Boulevard. My name's Rusty.
Northwest corner of Broadway
and
Craycroft.
It's at the corner of Broadway and Craycroft.
Right, right.
But hopefully, again, if and when we will be moving,
right.
we're going to do a, you know, let people know that, but I want right. to make sure that's in writing first. But
yeah, yeah.
But Davis Kitchens, it's been an institution. It's been there 50 years. So,
yeah, yeah. Well, you know, and I think 50 years ago is when I called on him in the very beginning mm. there.
Mm.
And Jane Art, I said that a second time I've said that, Jane Hamilton Fine Art Gallery. Art walk this Thursday from 4 to 7, a great experience to go up and one.
Food, just, music, wine, it's lovely.
And meet the artist, too.
Meet the artist, meet cool. who lives here, meet who's featured,
yeah.
and all of our neighbors, and... it's a lovely time to come.
And you're located at the north...
I'm at the southwest corner of Skyline and Campbell.
Skyline and Campbell.
Under the Copper Dome on either side.
Right, right. You can see it from all corners of the street
yeah.
there. And you're one of our big fans of The Morning Voice. Of course, you're a former radio person yourself.
I had my own radio show here 25 years ago.
Yeah, and you've introduced us to the Davis Kitchen folks, and we want to help you however we can help you, Rusty, and get you guys... as much business as we can coming through the doors. And hopefully they'll walk in and say, I heard you on The Morning Voice. That would be a great thing. So.
Well, yeah. It was a pleasure to meet you, and yeah. we love what you do. And
okay.
And appreciate you having us down.
Great. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back in a little bit. We'll talk with Dr. Vance Holliday from the University of Arizona about the good things going on at the University of Arizona. Our special thanks to Jane Hamilton of Jane Hamilton Fine Art Gallery and Rusty Booth of Davis Kitchen. Make it a great day, a really positive, wonderful, fantastic day. We'll see you guys in a little bit. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. On Fridays, we talk about the good things happening at the University of Arizona, and we call it Wonder, sponsored by Caruso's Italian Restaurant on 4th Avenue and Hughes Federal Credit Union. Along with me is co-host Sixto Molina. Good morning to you, Sixto.
Good morning, sir.
And our other surprise co-host is Alan Kaith. Good morning, Alan Kaith.
I didn't know I was going to be a co-host. I just came in to tell you hi.
Well, you're good. And I
guess I'm a co-host, right, Sixto?
You got that right.
I got nominated.
I roped you into sitting down and talking to us this morning.
Bill could be the co-host.
Yeah, there you go. He's with us every week, yeah. How are you doing, Alan?
I'm okay. I'm up here. I came in the neighborhood because my daughter has early school, and it's in this area right now. So I thought I'd say hello.
I have an open invitation to you. You can come anytime you want.
Oh, I appreciate it.
I do the same thing with Sixto. I say, Sixto, anytime you want to come, you are more than welcome. Hey, with us for Wonder, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona, our special guest today is Dr. Vance T. Holliday. He's the Koffler, Professor Emeritus, School of Anthropology and Department of Geosciences at the University of Arizona, and he's also the director of the Argonaut Archaeological Research Fund. So good morning, Vance.
Good morning, Ed. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, before we get started here, just tell us a little bit about your emeritus now, but tell us a little bit about your trip and being part of this long journey at the University of Arizona.
Oh, thanks. Well, I was hired in 2002, and the Argonaut Fund you mentioned was an endowed research fund for specifically trying to better understand the earliest peopling of the Southwest. When did people, indigenous populations first arrive here, and what were they doing and what happened to them? And so that was a research interest of mine. So that's what I've been doing in the Southwest. And then most recently, we finished up this work in the White Sands area where we confirmed some ancient trackways.
Yeah, that dates back 21,000 to 23,000 years ago in the White Sands area, far, far older than previously thought about. How does this reshape our understanding of human activity in North America?
It's a pinpoint on a map, so it's hard to get out that there's so few archaeological sites anywhere in the Americas that old, and even somewhat younger or older. So it's the most important thing is that it is a data point telling us that there were people here at that time. It's hard to say much else. They were fully modern humans. They would almost certainly related to the indigenous populations that we know today, although the direct genetic relationship, that's a whole other issue that we can't get at. So it's an important data point.
Alan, you have a question there. I know you were begging to get in with a question.
I was at White Sands 3 years ago with my daughter, who was in the Scouts. Never been there, and not sure how long your scope of work was there. How long were you there? A couple of years, or are you still there?
I've been working out there since 2012 and finishing up. I retired a few years ago, finishing up some loose ends. So however long that's been, every summer or once I retired, I could go anytime I wanted. A week here, a week there. That's sort of the way I've done the work.
As you're wrapping up, what's the latest thing that has interested you over there? I mean, even in the last couple of months, have you found something that really has surprised you?
Well, this project that we published this summer that Ed was interested in is certainly part of that, this confirming the age of these footprints. Related to that is the history of, there are two ancient lakes in the area, and I've had a long interest in people and lakes, and there were many ancient lakes in the Southwest and Western U.S. Wilcox is another one. It was a big lake
during the Ice Age. And so that's a related interest, and I want to try to tie up some loose ends. There's a lake near the Trinity site, Paleo Lake Trinity, near the atomic bomb site, and there's nothing published on it, and so I'm trying to finish up some of that work to put that story in the context of the other lakes. There's a lake where the tracks were to the south of Lake Trinity. And so learning more about those lake systems and how people, the early populations, not as old as the tracks, but the earlier populations, so-called Clovis and Folsom, how those people interacted with the lake systems. So those are the kind of things I've been pursuing.
Way off track here, but we were talking about going to Hatch to get some chilies and talking about traveling out on I-10 East. But sometimes when I go down to, we have Apple Annie's coming on in a couple of weeks here. When we go down to Wilcox, sometimes you look off to the south and there's big pools of water, like little mini lakes. Mm-hmm. Is that because of the clay and stuff that's in the rock formations in the ground that creates this pooling effect that makes it kind of like a lake bed?
Right there, south of town?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an ancient lake bed. And during the Ice Age, there was just a lot more water on the landscape, mm-hmm. more rain, less evaporation. And so it collected a lot more water. Today, you only see it when it rains. But yeah, as a result of lakes, there are a lot of clays. And then during wetter times, the whole water table was higher. So right. that's part of that story.
Very interesting. Our guest this morning for Wonder is Dr. Vance Holliday, the Koffler Professor Emeritus in the School of Anthropology and Department of Geosciences. And your emeritus status, which means that you've wrapped up your day-to-day teaching and so forth, but you're still there involved on a regular basis. And what are you working on in terms of this project, but also other projects that you have young people helping you from the University of Arizona?
There's one student now. Since I retired, I haven't taken students, but there's a student, Jason Wendingstadt, in environmental sciences. He's been working with me. I'm trying to synthesize all the work we've done. As I said, I've been working there in the White Sands area since 2012. That includes the Missile Range, the National Park, Holloman Air Force Base, Fort Bliss. It's a huge area, which has been a remarkable opportunity to have access to this and to understand how the landscape evolved as the early populations arrived, as I was talking about. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to synthesize that for a book. So writing has been my main focus since I retired.
Right, right. So these footprints are really important, and because it kind of changes the view of what we think happened back in this. Of course, we didn't have social media to record our footprints. So these actual footprints are the record of human existence back then, and you're able to date them and get them back there. But this is this is an interesting story about how people lived 20,000, 23,000 years ago, and where they lived, and that's a great insight into the past, is it not?
Yeah, it's. I should mention, human tracks, they're very ephemeral. By definition, all archaeological sites had human tracks at some point, unless it was on bedrock.
Right.
Almost no archaeologist has any experience dealing with tracks, with footprints, because they haven't noticed them, they don't preserve well, and we're not trained to look for them. Right. So that in itself has been a real eye-opener, is seeing these things, seeing these tracks preserved. There must be more. And so now we know what to look for. But yeah, they're on a floodplain where a stream came off the mountains to the east and then flowed out into this ancient lake. And so they're walking around on this floodplain with the lake and a wetland, probably within a couple hundred yards at most. So quite a varied environment. Plus, we also know that there were ancient animals, the so-called megafauna, mammoth. There are mammoth tracks associated with the human tracks. There was giant ground sloth. There was a kind of camel that lived in the area. The dire wolf that some people may know from the, I don't know, it's not science fiction, but the fiction stories. Dire wolf. Quite a menagerie out there, big animals and presumably lots of small animals. So quite a great environment to attract people.
Right.
Okay. Many of the footprints belong to not to artifact-bearing adults, but to teenagers and children.
what does this detail reveal about their behavior or daily lives? And then I have a follow-up question
sure.
to that.
Yeah, that's a good question. It's not easy to answer because we had such a small look. There are about 60 individual footprints in 8 layers. So that's a not even a keyhole into what was going on. And you tend to, as I understand from the track experts, you tend to find more tracks of younger people, in part because, you know, if you have two parents, they're going to have kids, right? So automatically you're going to have more people around. But presumably you have families out there. All we know right now is they're walking from A to B. We don't know where A was and we don't know where B was. And that's, right now, that's the story we have. But they're clearly out on this floodplain doing something, presumably taking advantage of the resources that were out there. And because they're on this floodplain, that means there was fresh water coming into the lake, because otherwise the water was probably pretty jippy. That lake produced the gypsum that eventually produced the white sands. Mm-hmm. That's the biggest gypsum dune field in the world out there. And so we don't know what the water was like, but it probably wasn't great, except where this floodplain was.
So my follow-up question is, White Sands isn't that far from Area 51. Have you found any footprints from any space creatures?
No. Of course, White Sands is a missile testing facility. Right. So we find pieces of rockets. Somewhere out there is a V-2 from the Second World War, but no.
That was good. That was good, Sixto. Our guest this morning, you're listening to the scholarly words of, as we get into science fiction and Area 151, the scholarly.
Didn't know we were doing Art Bell today, but yeah, I'm down with it, man. Yeah. This is good. I like it.
This is Wonder, and we're talking to Dr. Vance Holliday, the Koffler Professor Emeritus at the School of Anthropology and Department of Geosciences at the University of Arizona. The White Sands that we're talking about, it's obviously a missile range and so forth, but it's also a protected national park. So the juxtaposition of having a national park and a missile range right in the backyard there is kind of an interesting thing to kind of, when you're researching, it's got to take both those things into consideration, right?
Yeah, it's been an absolutely terrific opportunity because it's such a huge, when you add it all up, just the missile range alone is 140 miles north-south, and it's largely untouched. And of course, the national park, same by definition, it's a national park. So it's a remarkable opportunity for fieldwork. There are limitations, obviously, in the park. People ask me, well, how come you haven't done more digging to where these tracks are? I'm not in charge of the digging, but it's a national park. You don't just show up with shovels and backhoes and start moving dirt. So right. that's an issue. On the missile range, the biggest sort of day-to-day issue is that sometimes they close the missile range because they're blowing stuff up, and sometimes they close the park. But that's a day-to-day issue, which I'm perfectly happy to deal with. But otherwise, it's been an outstanding opportunity for research.
Right. You know, you spent about 50 years studying the peopling of Americas. How does this finding itself fit into that arc of your career, and what lessons do you think it holds for anthropology and geoscience?
It's been a remarkable opportunity. It's been just one of these fortuitous situations where one thing leads to another. I got hired to pursue this topic, and by happenstance, I was invited to the park in 2012 to look at what they thought were human footprints that were very old. It turns out they were giant ground sloth, but that was my entree to the park and then the missile range next door. So The whole thing, even without the tracks, has just been a terrific opportunity for me. So I can't be enthusiastic enough, at least as far as my work goes and what we're learning out there and working with students out there.
Right. And, you know, I'm all about the students and the young people at the U of A. For young researchers or students who might be listening, or their parents or grandparents who have young people that are kind of interested in this kind of stuff, I have a kind of a play on words here. What advice would you offer those who may follow in your footsteps, excavating landscapes, questioning timelines, and pushing the boundaries of our past?
There is so much about the past we don't know. And, of course, the farther back in time we go, the less we know. So there's still so many questions in history, recent history, ancient history, archaeology, geology. It's endless. I think just what I was taught as an undergrad and as a grad student, a lot of that is, now we know, isn't necessarily wrong, but we know so much more.
Right.
And I can look back. I have books, textbooks, that are outdated because we've learned so much.
Right. That's kind of a neat thing, yeah.
Yeah.
I know we're coming up at 8:30 and we take a little break, but have you determined why people stopped living there?
No. This whole issue of the peopling of the Americas, the earliest widespread evidence for occupation of the Americas begins about 13,000 years ago. This so-called Clovis, they made these distinct artifacts. They're everywhere.
Yeah.
Before that, it's a site here and a site there. One may be 1,000 years earlier than Clovis. Another one might be 2,000 years in Clovis. And that's one of the biggest mysteries, is what was going on. I happen to think that people got over here in dribs and drabs and didn't survive. And then another group, couple of thousand years later, maybe got over here, survived for a little while.
It had to be water related.
Well, you have to have water. No matter where you go, people have got to have water. And there was plenty of fresh water 21,000 years ago. So that's not an issue. Of course, it's also a preservation issue. You have to preserve the sites. You have to preserve the footprints. And that's always the problem.
Right. Well, we really appreciate you coming and bringing your insights today about the cool things going on in human development and geosciences and archaeology and so forth, anthropology. It's an interesting, the Earth, through its rock formations, does kind of give us a history. We don't, you can read the planet. You know, we're famous at the U of A for the tree ring of trees, giving us a historical perspective of weather and other things that can, but rocks really do that same thing, don't they?
You go up to the Grand Canyon. That's the best example in the world.
And you can see the different things happening over the millennia, right?
Exactly, yeah.
It's like a recorder of ancient history, and that's a cool thing. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to ask you one last question, and we ask this of all of our University of Arizona guests. You're part of Wonder, part of that whole cool thing that's going on. What is one thing at the University of Arizona that you think is full of wonder?
The faculty in general, but the faculty I know in the disciplines that look at the past, historians, the archaeologists, the geologists, they're all trying to understand what went before us, because we're all a product of infinite number of events that happened in the past. And it's a world-class group of people there thinking about looking at the past, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's amazing to me just we've had over the last 19 months, Alan's been here, Sixto's been here, Bill's been here, Matt's been here, just to get the exposure that we've had to so many wonderful researchers and so many people who are answering the important questions in our life, or asking the important questions, maybe not answering, but they're asking the important questions. And so I'm with you. I think the research we do at the U of A is just full of wonder, and the faculty are an amazing group, and with a little bit of help from our students from time to time, it's an amazing thing. Special thanks to our guest for Wonder this morning, Dr. Vance Holliday, the Koffler Professor Emeritus at the School of Anthropology and the Department of Geosciences. And I want to thank Alan for stopping by. You can stay around for the next session if you'd like.
I'm going to ask Vance if we can go build a white sand castle.
I like that. I like that. I like that. And Sixto Molina is with us. We'll take a break here. We'll come back with the second half of Wonder, sponsored by Caruso's Italian Restaurant. By the way, Vance Holliday, I'm going to give you a gift certificate from Caruso's so that you can run down there, and they're an official sponsor of The Morning Voice. And our other friends are Hughes Federal Credit Union.
They've been around so long, there may be footprints there in that backyard.
Exactly, exactly. We'll be back in just a minute, and you're listening to The Morning Voice. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley. On Fridays, we talk about the good things happening at the University of Arizona, and we call this Wonder, sponsored by Caruso's Italian Restaurant on 4th Avenue and Hughes Federal Credit Union. With me in studio is our wonderful guest hosts, plural. We have Sixto Molina. Good morning, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Eckerly.
We've been through a lot of these interviews. So the fascinating advance holiday, fascinating, wasn't it, to talk about footprints from 25,000 years ago?
Absolutely. I just came through that area last week, so I know exactly where he's.
You and your Area 151 stuff. And with us as well as Alan Kaith. Alan, so great to have you here. The door is always open for our, what do we say? If the phone's not ringing, it'll be me, right?
That's yours and my inside joke. Yeah. If you don't need me, you won't call.
Right.
So I just came in to say hello, and because here I am as a guest host.
Because I haven't called you for a while.
That's right.
That's great. Our guest for Wonder this morning is Dr. John Elfar. He is the chair of the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. Good morning to you.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you. So let's start a little bit. Could you share with us your background and how you came to be the chair of Orthopedic Surgery at the College of Medicine at the University of Arizona?
Well, I was at Penn State. I was the vice chair of orthopedics there, and the opportunity came up. The dean here at the University of Arizona contacted me, and I applied, and I had never been to the Southwest. I had grown up on the East Coast, so my wife and I came out to take a look, and we fell in love.
That's great. And most people do when they land at the University of Arizona and in Tucson, Arizona. They fall in love with the weather and the four mountain ranges around us and all the wonderful things that go on here. That's one of the reasons we do Wonder, is because we talk about the good things. So could you explain what 4-aminopridine, aminopridine, did I say that right?
Aminopyridine.
Aminopyridine is, see, I don't even know what it is and how it is used for multiple sclerosis.
So none of us actually say the whole name. We say 4-AP. 4-AP is a drug that has been around for 30 years. And as drugs go, it's not the greatest drug. It does some help for the multiple sclerosis patients. It helps them stand up and walk a little better. But it isn't their first-line drug. Mm-hmm. And I started using 4-AP because we had experiments in which a simple 4-AP experiment would have proven something that we wanted to do. It was unrelated to bones, mm-hmm. and I'm an orthopedic surgeon.
So I took your picture. Did you notice?
I did.
I did that way. They saw that on TV. They saw me. They were live on YouTube, so they saw me take that picture. So that's pretty funny. Sixto's got a question for you.
So how did your team come to investigate this drug in the context of bone healing?
So we were studying nerve injury, and there's this new way to study cells where you can look at everything that a cell is doing. It's called RNA sequencing. And so we did an RNA sequencing screen on nerve injuries, and we found out of the 30,000 genes that can get altered in that particular screening, we found a lot of bone-related genes. I was very happy about that because I'm an orthopedist. And so we started looking at individual genes, and we found that 4-AP increases the expression of ORI1. ORI1 is a protein. It's a calcium channel that a lot of people now are beginning to believe is a channel that marks the beginning of bone weakness. Humans make ORI1, but they make less of it as they age. And so people are looking at this as a target for bone homeostasis, the idea that a bone stays strong over time. And we found that 4-AP upregulated or increased the expression of this particular gene sevenfold in nerve injuries, no bone. So we decided to do fracture experiments specifically because of that finding. But it was luck.
Could this mean that as people age, that if they get on a regimen of this, that it would be helpful for them? As you know, there's always the fear of falling and breaking a hip or falling and breaking something. Is that a good thing? Is that kind of what you're targeting?
I'm smiling because we're writing the grant right now. The idea that 4-AP, a drug that's been around for a long time, could have this use either in fracture healing in elderly patients or in general for bone homeostasis, that is a very attractive idea. And so we're writing that grant right now.
So it would kind of be an insurance policy for some people if they have a tendency to, break things. It's good to have something to kind of mitigate that.
Wouldn't it be great if a cheap generic drug could do that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's good. How was the? I don't want to get too far into politics here, but how is the grant funding going in the state of our current politics with so much being canceled and reallocated and things going in different directions? Are you pretty safe in the grants and the things that you guys are working with?
We're luckier because what we do is treat trauma patients. And so no one wants to get in the way of trauma patients. No one wants to get in the way of fracture management. And it's sort of universally appealing, both at the NIH and the Department of Defense. So we've been lucky in that regard.
Mm-hmm. So a grant that is mitigating some of that in the future is maybe not as dangerous as something that would be a little bit more esoteric or perceived to be less important, as they say.
Yeah. True.
Yeah. So, what are the advantages of repurposing an existing drug? And are there other examples of a drug that's been repurposed like you're doing? Obviously there is, but I can't think of any off the top of my head. But is there some examples of drugs being repurposed like this in other areas?
So drug repurposing is the best deal that medicine can provide. Mm-hmm. Because the development of a new therapeutic by, let's say, a pharmaceutical company costs hundreds of millions of dollars. And also, that new therapeutic might not work. And it takes all of that investment to figure out that it doesn't work. But drug repurposing has some benefits. You don't have to prove that a drug that's already proven to be safe is safe. So a lot of the cost goes away. And you also don't have to invent the drug, make a chemical process. So drug repurposing is attractive. The problem with drug repurposing is it is so cheap that some companies won't actually get involved in a drug repurposing trial. Drug repurposing often involves drugs that are already generic. So although the treatment is cheap, you might find that there's not a lot of people who want to get around you and donate the small cost it takes to test a drug. And what you really have to do is you have to do clinical trials to test a drug, to test whether it works, and then to test what it doesn't work on, because you need those exclusion criteria to tell doctors like me, use it here, don't use it here.
I've got something. You and I watch TV, right?
Less and less. But
do we like the drug commercials?
No, I don't think anybody likes the drug commercials.
And I don't like them only because of all the side effects at the end.
Uh-huh.
Does 4-AP have any side effects?
There's no drug anywhere that doesn't have side effects. In fact, we use drugs because of side effects we like. We call those treatment effects.
Right.
I think
bad effects.
Yes.
Though.
The bad 4-AP? Side effects of 4-AP exist, but they usually exist for overdosing 4-AP. And the other thing is they exist much more in the population that 4-AP is currently approved for, which is multiple sclerosis patients. Mm-hmm. And so we're actually lucky because trauma patients, orthopedic trauma patients, nerve injury patients, they are less likely to have the side effects. But yes, 4-AP has side effects like any other drug. And I think personally that we're testing this, at least in clinical trials in other areas, we're testing this on low dose.
It doesn't cause death like the TV commercials say. No. May cause death.
No. You have to do a lot with 4-AP to make it do that, I think.
You know, I have this thought in my mind as you were talking about the big drug companies not wanting to repurpose a drug because of the lack of profitability is a way to say it, perhaps. And the reason that we're seeing so much advertising for these drugs, Alan, is because those are profitable drugs, and the drug companies are making a lot of money off that. But what I heard was an opportunity for an entrepreneurial drug company to come in, a small company, to come in and be nimble and to help you work through that process. So maybe there's
There's also, though, people that will abuse that. There was a guy that took orphan. Is this kind of an orphan drug in a way?
They talk about orphan drugs for things that no one will develop a treatment
right.
for. An orphan drug treatment is for that rare disease. My diseases don't qualify as orphan diseases because so many patients have fractures or nerve injuries. We'll get 10 of them a night in our hospital. So although the drug is orphaned by the pharmaceutical company, in reality, orphan conditions, they're even a bigger problem.
It seems, though, that there was a guy that went to jail and gave up all of his money because he took these orphaned drugs and then racked up the price to hundreds of thousands of dollars a dose. Are yes. you familiar with that gentleman?
His name was Shkreli, and
Max Shkreli or something.
I don't
like
remember
that?
His first name.
Yeah.
But yeah, he basically collected a few of these orphan drug
exactly.
treatments that were, and then he made them exorbitant.
Exactly.
So many patients couldn't get access to the drug. Remember that most patients get access to drugs if insurance covers them.
Right.
And insurance loves generic drugs. It loves right. the kinds of drugs that I study. Mm-hmm. But some of these fancier treatments that only work, let's say, in 10,000 people in the world, drug companies don't spend a lot of money developing those treatments, and that's why the orphan drug designation exists. Mm-hmm. And he did do that.
Yeah.
And he did go to jail.
He did. He gave up all his money, too. Hundreds of millions of dollars. I remember that. I thought, how can somebody just take it, something that's already there? He didn't invent anything. He watched the thing become an orphan or researched it and then went ahead and made enough to where it was still scarce and charged a ridiculous amount of money. That could not happen with 4-AP, do you think?
It's already generic. Although I will tell you, when I started work on 4-AP 10 years ago for other conditions, it was actually run by a company, and that company did not want to give us the drug for trials. Hmm. And it was only when it went generic that the trials started getting
Got
approved
it.
For me.
Right.
So I was lucky.
We'll take a quick break and we'll come back with a final segment of Wonder. We're with Dr. John Elfar, who is the chair of Department of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. This segment is sponsored by Caruso's Italian on 4th Avenue and Hughes Federal Credit Union. And you're listening to KVOI, and this is Wonder on The Morning Voice. Welcome back to The Morning Voice. I am your host, Dr. Ed Ackerley, along with my co-host this morning, Sixto Molina. Good morning again, Sixto.
Good morning, Dr. Ackerley.
And good morning, Alan Kay. Thanks for stepping in today.
I just came by to say hi, and here I am.
Here you are. Here you are. As well as
extra Bill, chair with a mic.
Bill Ackerley's here with no mic, and Matt is in the control room. Thank you, Matt, for being flexible this morning. We appreciate all you do to help us. On Fridays, we talk about the good things happening at the University of Arizona, and we call it Wonder. It's sponsored by Hughes Federal Credit Union. It's also sponsored by Caruso's Italian Restaurant on 4th Avenue. And our guest for Wonder is Dr. John Elfar. He is the chair of the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at the University of Arizona College of Medicine. And Dr. John Elfar, I have a little gift certificate for you for Caruso's, thanking you for your good work at the U of A, and take your family down and have some good Italian food.
Okay? Thank you. Thank you very much.
I have a feeling that they use bones in the broth for the pasta.
That'll make it taste good.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. So we were talking before the break about this neat idea of using an existing drug and repurposing it to get some healing on bones and other things. Of course, you're an orthopedic surgeon, so bones are important to you. Who are the people that benefit most from this? We talked a little bit about older adults, but who are the people that are going to be most impacted by this drug?
Well, I think that there's two sort of areas of impact. The first is the patients who wouldn't go on to heal quickly or reliably. And that isn't just elderly patients. Some patients are sick in a way that they don't make bone callus. They don't fuse bones. So that's one group of people. People who have habits that prevent bone healing, like smoking. But then there's another group of people. This is the bigger group. Young people who would otherwise heal, but it's going to take them 3 months. We think about bone fractures as things that heal quickly. Well, mm-hmm. they don't heal quickly. Takes right. weeks and weeks.
Right. So when you have a professional athlete that's on, like, say, a baseball team, they get hit in the back of the hand and they break a bone, they're out for 4, 5, 6 weeks, and people are saying, "Why, that's taken a long time." Could this help them?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Speed that up. So I would think that the professional teams would be very interested. We ought to write a grant to the NFL and see if they will help sponsor some of this.
Cause, absolutely.
You get a Joe Montana break like that, or Joe Theismann, I guess it was.
Joe Theismann.
Yeah.
Ended his career.
Ended his career, get a severe break like that, and maybe this could be helpful. So we were just talking kind of off air about how 4-AP might be able to be used topically as well. So right now it's taken orally, but talking about how you might be able to develop a systemic delivery of it topically. What are the prospects of that down the line?
The prospects of that are pretty good. I think a local delivery inside the body is also good. We've shown that we can inject materials that slowly release 4-AP over an injury, and we can also paint 4-AP onto a patch of skin and get the levels of 4-AP at an injury site that we need to induce healing. So I think that the prospects are good.
Is this a good example for other drugs? Are there other drugs that are being repurposed for bone healing and so forth? Or is this the one you've discovered and it's kind of it for right now?
Well, for bone healing, this is a new foray for us. But there are other drugs that are used to induce bone healing. Not many, incidentally. But drug repurposing exists all over medicine, especially in cancer.
Mm-hmm. Viagra.
Yes. Or repurposed. Rogaine.
I don't want to know how it was repurposed, Alan Keith.
It was used for blood pressure, wasn't it? Initially a blood pressure medicine.
Well, you know, and the one that everybody talks about is Rogaine. Rogaine was a heart medicine before anybody sort of knew that it was making people like me grow more hair.
Follically challenged, as they say.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
You know, all of us in this room are follically challenged as I'm looking around here.
Well, let me ask you this. I know we're running out of time, Edward. I'm watching the clock because I'm just like you. I'm an old radio guy. You said you're writing a grant for this. I'm going to say when the grant is approved, because I'm an optimist. Actually, I'm a realist.
We love optimists.
In this case, I'm an optimist. Will you need people to help you develop your thesis on this, and will they be volunteers, and how do they get a hold of you, or is there going to be a link that maybe Ed could put on his Accurately Advertising website to find out more about people that would qualify for maybe help you with the grant?
Well, academic medical centers like mine and areas like mine, we live on donors and volunteers. The way to contact us is to contact the University of Arizona Department of Orthopedics here in Tucson. And yes, we will find a link and give you it.
Ed will put it on. I guarantee you'll put it on.
Thank you, Dr. John Elfar, Chair of the Department of Orthopedic Surgery at the U of A. Thank you, Alan Kay. Thank you, Sixto Molina. Thank you, Bill Ackerley. Thank you, Matt Neely. Have a great weekend. Up next is Win Tucson, and you're listening to The Morning Voice. We'll see you next week.